Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. Thank you all for joining us this morning. As I mentioned in our emails, it's World Hunger Month. So we appreciate anybody who brought in donations and look forward to hearing about this from three different perspectives. So Alan Thornton is the Chief Executive Officer of the Syracuse Rescue Mission. The Multi-Regional Rescue Mission Alliance of Syracuse serves thousands of individuals a year with programs in Syracuse, Auburn, Binghamton, and Ithaca. Under his leadership, the organization is one of the first missions to rapidly expand new progressive housing models and is placing more than 700 people a year into permanent housing. He has been at the helm of the largest building projects in the rescue mission's history, including a $7.2 million Alice C. Barber Day Center and the Kai Sweater Emergency Shelter. Alan holds an MBA from Syracuse University and has more than two decades of experience in the nonprofit sector. Kathleen Stress was appointed the executive director of the Central New York Food Bank in 2013. She has been at the food bank since 2007, serving as chief operating officer and director of internal operations. Kathleen began working in the nonprofit field in daycare 20 years ago. She is responsible for the overall operation of the agency with final approval of all fiscal, program, employment, and facility decisions, functions, changes, policies, and procedures. Kathleen earned a master's degree in public administration from SU's Maxwell School and a Bachelor of Arts degree from SUNY Fredona. Julie Gilbert began at the Samaritan Center in 2008 as a guest service and volunteer coordinator, having been placed through the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. After quickly falling in love with the mission of the center, she transitioned into the role of resource and referral specialist in 2010. A Philadelphia native, Julie graduated from St. Joseph University, where she studied English. Julie's position at the Samaritan Center directly addresses its mission to promote the dignity, welfare, and self-sufficiency of its guests. Please join me in welcoming our three guests today.
So I just wanted to give an opportunity for those who may not know what the food bank's work is that we are the primary food supplier to 11 counties, so we cover about 25% geographically of New York State. And we work with various food partners, so you'll get to talk with Samaritan Center and Rescue Mission, who are two of our partners today, but we have 364 partners across our 11 counties, both emergency food programs, so they're categorized as food pantries, emergency food shelters, and soup kitchens. And then we also have about 105 that are considered non-emergency, so it's daycare centers, senior centers, and residential programs. I gave the audience, a few of you, a piece of paper with a number on it. All I need you to do, if you have that number, could you stand up for just one moment at your table? That's all I need you to do is stand up. Great. What this demonstrates is in this size group right here, one in eight individuals in our community are food insecure, which means they don't know where their next meal is coming from. It's going to be short term. It could be a long term impact. It could be based on a medical situation or employment, if your employment changes. But what we are finding, go guys, thank you. I'm sorry, you can sit down. I'll make you stand the whole time. No. So what that really demonstrates is the opportunity that there is local hunger, and I know that we're in the context of world hunger, but we focus here on local hunger, and when we try to make sure that our communities have the food resources they need to feed their individuals. So we're making sure that within our 11 counties, those who are hungry and who we primarily serve are families, so working families. So when you hear that it's all the families on welfare or who don't have a job, that's a misnomer. But majority of the people that we serve are working families. They're trying to make ends meet. They're working a full-time job but just don't make the threshold to get out of poverty. or they have a couple part-time jobs, and so because of that, they don't have medical insurance, or they're trying to pay for those things outside of their context. We have a lot of children that we serve within those families, so currently about 30% of recipients of the Emergency Food Network are children under the age of 18. And we have about 10% who are senior citizens. So we're working with our programs not only as an opportunity to make sure they have the food, but we also want to make sure that they have some access to other services. So I'm going to go through that just quickly, and then I'll turn it over to my colleagues to share their insights of how they actually provide the service. So for those of you who may not know, how the food bank works is we have primary acquisition and then distribution. So we work to acquire goods, both three commodity streams, donated, wholesale, and USDA. So the Farm Bill is very important to us right now. It covers SNAP and it covers a TFAP, which is USDA commodities that we get into the warehouse. And those are very high quality cuts of meats, fresh fruits and vegetables, frozen items. So that's important to us. We work with many companies and organizations to acquire donated product. We have a retail partner program where we're out working with Wegmans, Walmart, Sam's Club, Hannaford, Price Right, ShopRite, I mean, you name it, Target. We're collecting the food that they don't sell, which is still very usable, and we're able to bring that to our partner agencies that afternoon for distribution so families have it on their table that night. So I'll just give you a little example, and I use this at my United Way presentations, is when you go into Wegmans, say, and I know most of us when we're going shopping, you go to the bags of salad, and you go back and you pick the one in the farthest in the back behind because you want the one with the best date because that's going to be the best quality, right? And that one in the front, that's okay. You know, you don't realize that you just donated to the food bank. That one in the front... Yeah, so you're helping, you didn't even realize. That one in the front maybe has a couple of slightly diminished pieces of lettuce inside, but still very viable. Wegman staff are pulling that off the shelves for us, and we're delivering it to a program that afternoon. So see, you didn't even know your civic engagement. We have a 74,000 square foot distribution center, so that allows us to do our work. I call us the Costco of food banking. If you haven't had an opportunity to ever come out and see the center, we'd love to show it off. But it's really an opportunity to house all the dry product, freezer and cooler items, because we pick up a lot of perishable items and we want to make sure that we store them appropriately until we move them out the next day. And then we do this through, like I said, our programs. So again, 364 programs. They are the ones who are doing the direct service to the community. We did start to embark on this year a new initiative, and I'll get to that, called Mobile Food Pantry, where we're doing a little bit of direct service, but we rely on our network to be able to do that. I wanted to just paint a little picture of Onondaga County. We serve 11 counties, but I wanted to let you know that here's just the need right here in our county in which we reside. We have numerous programs, and our fiscal year runs July through June. So last year, when we just finished our fiscal year, June of 2017, almost 2.9 million meals were provided here in Onondaga County to families in need. And that is done through our partners. And so if you look at the overall scope of our service, we finished our fiscal year supplying 11.9 million meals to families across 11 county service areas. So local hunger is an issue. It still exists, and families are trying to use the Emergency Food Network as an opportunity to stretch their food dollars and make ends meet so they can put those, what they would probably spend on food, towards other needs, whether it's rent, whether it's transportation, whether it's medical needs. Some of the challenges that our families face, and I think you'll get a further insight to the actuals, but this comes from our hunger study that we just completed, and we find that a lot of families are employed, but they're living below an income level that doesn't allow them to get to the next step. A lot of them are also focused or have issues with health. So because they have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or diabetes, you know, they're not having access to wholesome foods all the time, which then continues to elevate the medical needs that they have, and then they're not able to get on the right path for a whole healthy, existence. So we are working to ensure that when you come to a food pantry or you come to a soup kitchen, that meal follows my plate guidelines. So you're making sure that at the very minimum, you have a fruit and vegetable, you have a protein, and you have a grain. So when you leave the pantry or when you go to a meal site, those are the items that are incorporated. Majority of the time, there's fresh fruit offerings at both pantry levels and at meal sites. But if there's not, we want to make sure that you have access to frozen or canned items to ensure that you have a whole well-balanced. Some of the federal programs that we rely on in order to do our work, particularly with a focus on feeding children, we want to ensure that kids are well-fed, not that we don't care about families and adults and seniors, but we focus on, through TFAP, the USDA program, we have summer feeding and we have Kids Cafe, and those two programs really help supplement. So kids are in school all day and they're having access to breakfast and lunch, and then if they go to an after-school program because their parents are working different shifts, they may not have the opportunity when they go home to have a meal. So we ensure that during the time you're at a recreation program that you're also having access to a hot meal. And then in the summer food service program, that actually is food bank's busiest time of year. So if you think all the time in which the kids throughout the year have access to school breakfast and lunch, they don't have that opportunity in the summer. So our pantry system, their capacity has to increase in order to ensure that those families can meet the needs of the feeding the children during the summer. And we also sponsor summer feeding sites through Boys and Girls Clubs, through rec programs, to ensure that those kids have access to breakfast and lunch. The reason why this is so important from a federal program is we have approximately 85% of kids here in Onondaga County participate in the school lunch and breakfast program. Only 20% participate in summer feeding. So there's that context of unmet need that we need to, we've identified, and we need to try to figure out how to get more families access to food. And then I just want to leave you with some innovative strategies that Food Bank has embarked on, so outside of just acquisition and distribution of food. So we want to be part of the public health realm. We understand that we are just one part of the solution, but that food is just one approach. And we want to ensure that we're feeding you and you have access to wholesome food, but we also know that it goes beyond that. So some of the programs that we're trying to reach, or at least go to a place where there's unmet need, helps us to then grow the opportunities. So when you're coming to a pantry or to a meal site, part of that is getting to know you and understanding what your family might need. So are you on SNAP? Do you have access to WIC if your family needs it? Do you have HEAP? As it starts to get chilly, like it's chilly in here this morning. Do you have insurance? So the program coordinators are going to work with you to get to know what your family needs are beyond that food, because that's just part of the approach. Do you have transportation issues? You know, are you able to access other government programs? So it's really trying to identify and help you move to self-sufficiency as a participant in our programs. But a couple of the other strategies is, you've heard about backpack programs, and that's kids taking home food on the weekends to try to either feed themselves. And also there's been a shift nationally across the Feeding America Network to have families, backpacks for families. Well, that's a lot for a little kid to take, and they're already carrying one backpack. So we are working, and we've done a pilot with 5 programs across our region, to convert backpack programs to school pantries where the families can access, they're already there, they can get the items, and they can take them home. That doesn't mean every family or every parent is still going to be capable of that, but we hope to lessen the burden for a child to have to bring home food and create a better access point for families to access food. So we've converted some of our backpack programs to school pantries. We've done the mobile food pantry, which I have a picture of. So our mobile food pantry van is one initiative where we're able to pick up excess produce, and we're able to distribute it out directly into the community. So we go to areas identified of unmet need, and we're really trying to supplement what our programs are doing out in the community. So if we're in the west side of Utica, and Thea Bowman and Mother Mary Ann are closed, and they're not open during that day. If they're open Tuesday, Thursdays, we're going to come in on a Wednesday, and we're going to help distribute directly out of our van to families in need. We advertise it, so it's typically those who are using the other programs. And there's no income restrictions, but it's an opportunity to increase capacity and increase access to fresh fruits and vegetables. We also do nutrition education. We are one of the lucky food banks where we have 5 registered dietitians on staff. So we're looking at meal packages. We're trying to define what wholesome is. We work with our donor population to ensure that they understand where we're trying to go in this field. And a prime example is Pepsi is a great supporter of us, but we don't distribute soda. So when we call Pepsi and say, you know, our philosophy is we don't distribute soda or candy, but Pepsi says, that's okay, we have iced teas and water. So we'll donate those to you. And so donors are working with us on a long-term basis as a strategy for public health and ensuring that people have access to healthy products. We do garden initiatives. So we work with our programs, so our emergency food programs, for produce mini grants. So they can work with farmers in their county to be able to access additional produce. So, you know, you get $1,000 to $3,000, and you can almost have your own little CSA at your program as an ability to increase the consumption point for your clients. And also we have gardening where you can do a garden on site. Some of the city plots, it's challenging. So we do raised beds, or we have a connection with a farmer. So that's pretty cool. And then the last is the pantry annex. And the pantry annex is really, again, just looking at our programs. So how can you increase the capacity of a food pantry? The constraint is most of the programs are small. They're in a basement of a church. They are run by volunteers. And so they don't have, they have a, not a commercial freezer cooler. They have a residential one. So this technology through SU's CoolBot system is an opportunity for us to really hitch it up to that agency. It expands their capacity for a cooler and allows them to keep it for weeks, months, as a distribution point to increase access to fresh fruits and vegetables. So I've said fresh fruits and vegetables 100 times. That's really one of the main focus points, is making sure that we increase that capacity. That doesn't make a meal, but we want to ensure that they have increased access to that, that allows them to supplement and then get the other items they might need at a grocery store. And then SNAP is the last. So SNAP is a very important part. SNAP is food stamps, for those of you who don't know formally that was what it was called. And it's really an opportunity to support local retailers, because for every dollar of SNAP, $1.70 is generated revenue back into the community. And it is an opportunity for families to pick and choose the items that they need. From an emergency food standpoint, if SNAP were to go away, the food banks could, and our programs could never pick up the capacity. We supply only about, 10% of meals of what SNAP does overall. So that's an important, I guess, referral program or opportunity that we want to continue to support and encourage. And I'm going to turn it over. This is usually how we always end. Do you want to switch careers? I'm sure you all want to come to the food bank now. But I'm going to turn it over to Julie next, right? And then we'll take questions at the end.
Good morning. thank you guys so much for taking the time to come out here this morning and learn a little bit about hunger. I just wanted to, first off, thank you guys for tolerating me instead of our executive director, Mary Beth. I'm very, very nervous being sandwiched between Kathleen and Ellen right here, so please bear with me. So I am here from the Samaritan Center, and some of you might know that we are one of 2 soup kitchens that serve every day of the year, the rescue mission being the other in Syracuse. The Samaritan Center is a much smaller operation. Our mission essentially is to feed our neighbors in need, and we do that without asking any questions. So many different kinds of folks come in to eat with us, and it's no questions asked. Philosophy really allows us to see a different, maybe, segment of the community than we might think. mention that I came to the Samaritan Center right out of college, so I had a lot of ideas. I was right about all of them, I'm sure, about what hungry folks would look like. I wasn't from Syracuse. I didn't really know who I would encounter. I thought, you know, a lot of the folks would be homeless, a lot of them suffering from mental health conditions or addiction issues, and I was wrong, as you might imagine. And the beauty of the Samaritan Center is that we serve this wide tapestry of the community. When we began really in 1982 as a brown bag lunch program out of St. Paul's Cathedral on Montgomery Street downtown. That first day that we opened, they served 30 bag lunches to folks in need. And it was super grassroots. Seven downtown churches each picked a day of the week to serve meals. And from that, we've grown to serving hot meals every day of the year. We added on professional staff in the 90s, mostly kitchen staff, and then an executive director, then a development director. And then my position in 2010 was created to really start addressing the tapestry of needs that we were really seeing from the folks that we were serving, to try and address that, all the, like Kathleen said, all the issues that surround hunger. In April of 2015, we moved to St. John the Evangelist Church. So some of you guys might remember our basement kitchen, and we moved up in the world for sure. It is an incredible facility. We used to seat 120 in our basement kitchen. We seat 180 now. There is heat, which we didn't have before. There's natural light. Heat is like very important, as we're all learning today. there's a ton of natural light. I think that the architect that designed our space said it best. He said, when you were coming downstairs into the kitchen at St. Paul's, your body responds a certain way to going down an alley and down a set of stairs and entering an enclosed space. You kind of like scrunch up, right? You look down. And when you enter into our new facility, the first thing you do is look up. And what a perfect way, what a perfect message to send to the folks that we're serving. We are mainly a volunteer organization. We utilize over 1,100 volunteers a month, which is incredible, and an incredible testament to the people of Syracuse. It's amazing every day to watch, you know, stay-at-home moms or business executives come down and serve a meal and just take time to be with other people. It really is incredible. And then last year, we served 118,471 meals. So we can see that the need in our community is great. I wanted to say a little bit about the programs that we offer. In addition to that, Kathleen couldn't have had a better introduction about the many different kinds of needs that we have that bring people to our table. We're trying to meet some of those needs first by like offering, we have a weekly computer lab. We have a program where we offer kind of apartment boxes, we call My Place, to folks that are just starting out in a new place, are moving from shelter or more likely having to shift apartments because of a code issue or an issue with pest, something like that. We offer a basic needs closet once a week, which provides soap, shampoo, conditioner, lotion, all of which you can't buy on food stamp benefits, which is a huge gap for those the people that we're serving. Just to give an idea, too, I think we take advantage so much of, like, when I can drive out to the Wegmans in Western Lights and they have a box of deodorant, right, that I can grab for a buck. If you go to a corner store, it's going to be probably about $4.50 for just a stick of deodorant, which is a huge segment of a lot of our folks' budgets. And we also have recently partnered with the Central New York Diaper Bank. We have 52 registered families that receive diapers for their child. We have 50. They distribute about 50 diapers a month, and that, again, is a huge budget issue because you can't, again, get that with food stamp benefits or with your WIC dollars. And they distribute to a number of other not-for-profits, including the Rescue Mission. And then we also, it's actually kind of funny because there's a couple folks in the audience that have done community outreach with us. The Samaritan Center's essential philosophy is that a meal is where we gather, right? It's where we talk with our friends, our family, about what the needs are in our lives. And the Samaritan Center tries to recreate that by bringing the experts to the table. We don't need to recreate programming. We don't need to, you know, be a health outreach worker. We don't need to be an employment program for women that are displaced. We can invite them to a meal, and then people can share their knowledge, share their resources. And it's a lot less scary for me to say, go to the second floor of the Civic Center and figure it out, figure out how to get food stamps, but to have Tracy from the food bank to come down and say, this is how we'll walk through it. This is what you're eligible for. They're arming people with knowledge and support, which is huge. We've also been able to partner with National Grid to host large community outreach opportunities for other folks in need, which has been awesome. And then the kind of case management we do is really first access. It's really trying to see why someone's here, figure out what it is, and work with them as an individual. So we really do that through partnership, which is huge. I think that I talk on the phone with Jim Hawley from the Rescue Mission 5 times a day, working with folks that are in shelter or that we're not trying to get inside. We talked to just yesterday about a couple that we found that are living in a shed on the north side. I mean, it's incredible the networking that the way that we all gather around food and how that's able to stretch out the resources and then really address all these other incredible needs. So we just consider ourselves one thread in this tapestry of services that our city is able to provide with such wonderful, incredible people, as I'm sure you guys know. So I did want to talk a little bit about demographics. I don't want to read it to you, but I mean, I think that we always find ourselves surprised at how many, what the diversity is. We have folks that own homes. We have a gentleman that we were helping get an electric wheelchair yesterday that has a doctorate in mathematics that eats with us. I mean, it's an incredibly diverse community that we encounter. I think that the other really big unmet need that we see at the Samaritan Center that might be a little bit unique is we see a lot of people that are couch surfing, which in federal government doesn't count as homeless technically. So it's really harder for us to get them resources and for them to qualify for a lot of housing programs. And then the other big, the demographic that you might see is 54% of our guests have been homeless within the last year. So while it's a smaller percentage that are homeless currently or living in shelter, you really see that people need food, help with food as a huge transition point. That moment that they get an apartment, that doesn't always mean stability for them. There's lots of considerations when you first are getting you're getting settled. So that's when people really do rely on us. We do really see our numbers too grow at the end of the month, because making up for the what SNAP dollars might provide in the beginning of the month around the 15th will go up, we'll start climbing steadily until the end of the month, where we might serve up to 400 folks at a single meal. And then last, I just kind of wanted to tell you guys a little bit, kind of paint like a couple faces of the folks that we might serve. The first person I wanted to talk to you guys about was a gentleman named Sean. He was a really, he was one of our younger guests, and he had eaten with us at our old facility. He was living at the Rescue Mission and really struggling. His temporary assistance allotment got him a room in a boarding house where he felt really unsafe on the south side, and he was really struggling. And he came to us still for meals, but I think mostly for support. He didn't have family. He didn't have a lot of local connections. And then one day he said, you know, I think I'm going to go back. I might go back home. I might go back. And we kind of stopped seeing him for a little bit. And he ended up actually coming back to see us after we had moved to our new facility with Little Caesars has this pizza truck. They like pulled up in front. and they were bringing in food, and he came with his company where he was working for Little Caesars in Fulton, and like saw all his old friends and saw us, and it was incredible for him to be able to be on the other side and running pizzas into the people that he had used to have to eat with. And he had an apartment that he felt safer in, and he felt so much better about his life, and it was just this incredible moment of him being able to not only reach back and give back to the folks that he was eating with, but to kind of show off a little bit all that he had accomplished, you know? It was really an incredible day. And the other person I hold really close to my heart, and I was thinking about him yesterday, is one of our guests named Dennis. Dennis started eating with us a number of years ago. He had just had a stroke and had been released from upstate. He was actually a professor of physics at a SUNY school. He was not tenured, he was a part-time professor. And after he had his stroke, he was unable to take care of himself. He was in this, like, you know, when we always talk about people that just fall through the cracks. He didn't qualify for almost any programs because he technically lived in a house that wasn't exactly in his name because his mother had left it to him, and there was some sort of will discrepancy. So when we were trying to apply for public assistance benefits for him, it just didn't work out because this house was and, you know, he had this house that was kind of in his name, but not really. The house was falling into disrepair. The lights were out. It was over on Rich Street on the south side. And Dennis would come to us, and he needed help with paperwork that he just couldn't understand. And it was, you could see this person that he had done. He had gone to school. He had lived through so much, and he just didn't have anything to fall back on. He got all of his health care from Assumption on the north side. He had chronic diabetes, which was really hard for him to manage without any money, as anybody who's diabetic knows. And it was a long struggle to keep trying to work with him to figure something out. He had a second stroke, and we lost Dennis. It was really hard on like our whole community because it was this wonderful gentleman who who he just, you know, there are times that people just need support, and they need a kitchen table to come to, and they need someone to share their lives with and help guide them on the way. And I think that that's the biggest lesson that I've learned in my time at the Samaritan Center, is that there are just so many wonderful people that just need to be with other people and need to break bread with them. And that's what the Samaritan Center does. Thank you, guys.
Well, good morning, everyone. I think a central theme that you're probably picking up is in our community, there's people that are falling through the cracks, that are on the margins, and they need people to surround them and support them, right? And that's the work of the Rescue Mission, that's the work of the Samaritan Center, and the work of the Food Bank, and so many agencies working together collaboratively to try to make sure that people have an opportunity to live their life at the fullest level that they're capable of doing that. And I'm proud of this community because we rally together around people in need. I think one of the markers of Central New York is that we care for our neighbors. And in my experience traveling around the country, talking to different communities, hearing the issues in different cities, the collaboration that takes place here amongst organizations and agencies and government and then the private community is just unbelievable. And that's why we're able to meet needs and touch people like Dennis and help others throughout our community. So very grateful to be here this morning to share a little bit about the work of the Rescue Mission. You know, our mission is to share hope, end hunger and homelessness, change lives, and strengthen communities one person at a time. And I think the best way to kind of talk about that is to share a little bit about someone that came through our program. His name is Jerry. I think the stories of individuals and what they've overcome is really a powerful motivator for all of us to connect to. So Jerry came to the mission probably 13, 14 years ago. After working in corrections for almost 25 years, lost everything due to mental health issues, due to addiction, and the police actually found Jerry in a field behind an abandoned garage and brought him down to the Rescue Mission. And Jerry's story was that he was so hungry at times and without food at times and not in his right mind at times that he would actually pick up pebbles and swallow them just so you would have something in his stomach. So when he came to the rescue mission, as you can imagine, after living out on the street, Jerry was very alienated, very much almost a shell of an individual, and very withdrawn. And our case managers went to work and started to connect with him, started to love on him and care about him, and started to understand the strengths that Jerry had and understand the gaps that he had, and started working on a plan. And before long, they realized, you know, he was eligible to get into our adult home. And so we're able to move Jerry into the adult home, and his life started to change from there. And I met Jerry in a different role when I used to do small group stuff with men at the rescue mission. And Jerry started faithfully coming to these group meetings that we would have on a weekly basis, but he was always really quiet. He'd show up, he'd help set up, put tables out, put chairs out, didn't say a lot, but just a quiet soul. So I remember one time we were sitting in a group, and I asked the men what had changed for them since coming to the rescue mission. And one by one, we're going around the circle, and individuals are sharing about what has changed for them. And we get to Jerry, and honest to God, I don't know if he's going to say anything. He's just that shy. And I will always remember this. So quietly he whispers, "I now have friends." So think about the power of that. You and I have friends. We understand what they do for us in terms of supporting us, building into our lives. They're there when we're going through challenges. They're there when we're celebrating victories. I mean, community and friendship means so very much to us, right? And what I realized through that encounter with Jerry was that, you know, the rescue mission and organizations like Food Bank and organizations like Samaritan Center, Catholic Charities, we are friends to those who feel they do not have friends. We're family to those that feel that they don't have family to turn to. And so when they come through our doors, often they're struggling and feeling like they don't have any hope. You know, that their life is pretty much got really, really bad, and they're just praying that it's not going to get any worse. And, you know, at that point in time, we have this opportunity to come alongside of them and believe for them and hope for them and show them that their life can change, that, in fact, they don't have to be defined by the fact that they're homeless or hungry or addicted or struggling with mental illness or physical health issues or relational issues. Those things don't have to define who they are and, most importantly, who they can still become. And at the Rescue Mission, that's what we believe is all about, changing lives. We want to see not just your immediate basic needs met, but we want to walk alongside of you, help you find the supports you need, build that plan to ultimately allow you to live your life the fullest possible that you can. And so as I walk through briefly kind of what does that look like, you know, think about Jerry and his story and think about if it started that way, how can it end? All right, so this is 2016, Rescue Mission Impact. You know, about 277,000 meals served. As earlier mentioned, the Rescue Mission operates programs in Syracuse, which is our hub where we've been for 130 years, but also Auburn, Ithaca, and Binghamton. 142,000 overnight stays provided, 948 permanent housing placements. So I get really excited about that because that's 948 less men, women, and children that are out on the street tonight under a bridge, in an abandoned building, or in a car. They have a place to call home just like you and I, and that's worth celebrating. Almost 400 people finding employment, and then over 10,000 individuals served just in 2016. Just here in Syracuse, we provided about 227,000 meals. Again, we're open 365 days a year. We provide breakfast, lunch, and dinner to anyone that's in need. If you're hungry, you can come, like the Samaritan Center, you can come to the Rescue Mission, and we're going to make sure that you're fed and that you have a meal. This is a typical morning. So this is, you know, right outside our food service center on Gifford Street. We start serving at 7. And so while you all were coming in this morning, while all of us were coming in, the lines were starting to form, doors were opening, people were starting to come in and get a meal. And so it can look that way, where literally crowds of people, hungry individuals, men, women, and children, waiting to come in and get a meal. We're seeing an increase in the number of families that we serve. I think Kathleen's point that 20% of, you know, children in the Syracuse City School District that only have access to the summer food program is huge. During holidays, during summer, we see an increase in families. We're always serving families every day, breakfast or dinner typically, but we see that spike during the summer. We certainly see it on holidays when schools are closed. And this is one of my favorite shots here, favorite pictures, because it comes back to that idea, like, you aren't just a number when you come through our door. You're not just someone that's hungry when you come through our door. You're an individual. You're a person. The person standing up is one of our chaplains here. And our staff works very hard, and our volunteers work very hard to engage individuals and really recognize their humanity. You know, because that's a great starting point. When you can see somebody as a person, at that point in time, a lot of things can start to change. I'm often asked, you know, what do you do about the person that's standing on the corner holding the sign and your car drives up to them and you hit that red light and you have that awkward moment? You know, do I look at them? What do I do? What do I give them? You know, we have all been there, right? Everyone has experienced that. And everyone asks, well, what should you give them? And the first thing I always say is, give them your attention. Just start there. Recognize their humanity. Ask them what their name is, how they're doing, what kind of day they're having. And from there, I think you can begin to build a relationship. And so that's certainly what we try to do in the Food Service Center during our meals, is connect with individuals, help them to know that we're here for them. Because as previously noted, it often begins with the meal. That meal is often the gateway to other programs and other access to supports. Because of the challenges in our food service center currently, so it was built, you know, a number of years ago. It seats about 70 to 80 people at a time, and you saw the crowd, the line out the door. We can serve upwards of 250 people during one meal setting. We'll serve up to 800 meals a day. So it was simply never designed to manage the number of people that were coming into our doors now. But the goal is to expand the footprint of our food service center so that we can expand our ability to bring people in. And you'll notice, like in our renderings here, one of the things that we want to do is welcome you into our home. So when you're dealing with individuals that are homeless, when you're dealing with individuals that are mentally ill, struggling with addiction, families having to bring their children to the rescue mission for a meal, we want to create as welcoming an environment as possible. And so we want to open it up and create that. We also want to create a space that will seat about 200 people at once so that we can quickly expedite and shrink that line so that people, you know, moms with strollers, vulnerable individuals aren't standing outside, you know, in central New York winters and springs and falls. They can get in and have a meal right away. The other thing we want to be able to do is double our volunteer capacity. We have over 4,000 volunteers that work with us in the course of a year. They donate about 110,000 hours of volunteerism every year. We simply could not do what we do without our volunteers. So we want to create a second service station so that more volunteers can come in and serve. And again, move people through our line quicker, get them seated in a welcoming environment, and have them not feel rushed to have a meal. If you're a family coming to the rescue mission, we don't want you feeling like you're in a hurry to then go. We want you to gather with your family and have a dignified time and have a good meal. We're also going to be building a family dining room as part of that space so that if, again, a family coming to the rescue mission doesn't have to end up necessarily splitting up to have a meal, but they can gather around a meal table together. So going back to Jerry's kind of story. So if you fast forward to where Jerry was, where he came into the shelter and he was broken and he came into our adult home and started to stabilize and he had connected with people and had friends. So I met Jerry, you know, it's got to be 13, 14 years ago. So Jerry, a good chance if any of you have ever gone to the downtown Cafe Cabal, you've met Jerry. Jerry works there 3-4 days a week. He's actually a greeter there, and he clears the tables and greets new guests as they come in, which is remarkable to think about. An individual that was just a shell of a person, right, that was so quiet and withdrawn, is now this guy with this beaming smile that's welcoming people at the door, that's just an ambassador of goodwill for our community. He's also taking classes up at OCC. He's reconnected with his family. He's traveled. Jerry's life has changed and transformed. And it It started when police found him, brought him to the rescue mission, and we started to work on his issues with them. He did all of the heavy lifting and the difficult work. We just supported him through that process. And a lot of times, you know, I hear from people, can lives actually change? And I think about Jerry's life. You know, had he stayed out in that field and not had an encounter with the mission, Jerry would probably be dead by now. You know, but now he's living a life so much fuller as a result of that. And I think it's just a reminder for all of us that when you see somebody that's on a corner holding a sign, you know, we don't know what's happened in their life up to that point to get them to that point. And we certainly don't know what can still happen in their life. We shouldn't write that story for them. We should come alongside organizations that are helping these individuals in the community and believe that their lives can change. So I just want to thank you for having us here this morning. Thank you for taking on this topic of hunger. Thank you.
One of the questions I wanted to ask all three of you is, as we come upon the holiday season, and I know there's continuity throughout the year, what are on wish list for the three of you?
So I know from the rescue mission perspective, you know, holidays means colder weather, so we're always looking for those very basic practical things that we can give to our guests coming into our shelter or that are out on the street that our outreach team is connecting with. So that's, you know, things like gloves, hats, you know, those basic essentials, coats, blankets, and then toiletry items go a long way for us. Again, if you've been out on the street for any amount of time, you come into the shelter, I mean, it's refreshing just to get things like deodorant, toothbrush, you know. So so very basic essentials to meet that holiday demand are key. Our numbers will go up in shelter. We'll probably hit 200 people at some point in time on a very cold night at the rescue mission shelter. You know, so it's one of those things where we want to be able to provide the basic essentials for them when they're coming in.
Yeah, and I would also add boots are another really big one, especially men's, because anything men's really is one of the hardest things to get donated. I think that we get more often like stuff for kids, which we love, and we have tons of kids that we can give it to, but men's stuff, especially in bigger sizes, is a huge need.
I'm going to be the outlier in the group and say money. The reason is we can buy food by the truckload, so every dollar becomes three meals back in the community. So when we're talking about outside of hygiene items, which we are working to with like Unilever and stuff to provide that now, but food we're able to buy by the truckload, and because we're able to buy in bulk, it goes a lot farther. So we try to convert, you know, our donors to funds versus food. It's great to have food drives. We have preferred, you know, lists. So always those staple items of cereal and pasta and tuna fish and peanut butter to get families through. But it really is all those additional items. Soup becomes a giant. You know, a can of hot soup is right now much more of essential as it starts to get chilly than it is the peanut butter sandwich. So I hate to say it, but money is going to convert to meet the needs.
Yeah. Good morning. I don't even know how to frame the question, but particularly for the Samaritan Center and the rescue mission, my question goes to, I know every person that comes, guests, whatever you want to call them, are unique situations of why they're there or why they showed up. My question goes to, is there a pattern as to how the people connect with, let's just say, the rescue mission or Samaritan Center and stay? Do they come just one time and then they're off and you maybe never see them again? Or are they more inclined to stay and connect something for a couple of weeks and then move on to somewhere else? Or is there no pattern to it at all?
So there's certainly a pattern depending on whether an individual is chronically homeless or whether the homelessness that they're experiencing is more episodic. So our goal when you come in to the shelter is that you've met with a case manager and done some sort of intake within 48 hours. And then based on that, we build an individualized service plan for you. So that's kind of your pathway out of shelter, because we don't want you staying in shelter. As long as you're in shelter, you're still homeless. And so our goal is to have you on to your next step within 45 days. And we're probably averaging in the low 20s right now in terms of being able to move people through kind of our pipeline of services and get them into housing. Certainly, like 20% that are chronically homeless of the homeless population consume a lot of resource and time and energy and support, and they're usually dealing with severe mental illness, severe addictions. And so they may take repeated trips and times in the shelter, working with our case managers before, you know, they're able to access recovery, behavioral health services, things like that. But the majority of individuals that we serve, you know, coming through shelter, and we'll see about 1,400, 1,500 people a year through shelter. The majority of them are episodic, and we're working with them on placing them and supporting them in a way that they won't return back to the Rescue Mission.
And I would add that I think that it kind of almost falls in like that rules of thirds. Like there are maybe a third of the folks that we see that are disabled that might have an income of, say, SSI. They're developmentally disabled, mentally ill, or have some other profound physical disability. The most people that have SSI are getting about $808 a month. So when you look at the cost of rent for a single person, they're not going to be able to afford food, even with some food stamp benefits. So those are the folks that we will see probably throughout their lives that are just vulnerable people that need support ongoing. Another third, very much like Alan was saying, will move on after they get stabilized. And I think we will see them a little bit longer, and then they'll move on. And then there's really just like a third that need food service support during a crisis period of their lives, be it a medical issue like Kathleen mentioned, or I think another big one that we see is people that are living in poverty suddenly having to move because the cost of a security deposit is so much that for, you know, a couple months that they'll really be struggling and won't have extra income for food.
Thank you very much for the teamwork that you all do. But a question that really comes to my mind is, I hear Puerto Rico, I hear lack of electricity to take care of or to keep things cool and fresh. Do you, in the food bank, have the type of, do you have generators, things that you could do when that big snow comes and brings down the wires?
Yes, we have a generator, and I will say Yvonne Bernard is the executive director of Puerto Rico, and she's been emailing the network and letting us know the food bank is up and running, but you still have ports of access where you can't get diesel or vehicles in to bring the food. But yes, most of the food banks are equipped to manage a disaster. In fact, we are part of the disaster relief efforts across the United States. So we're always equipped. We do this every day with a fleet of vehicles and distributing out food. So we have that opportunity when Puerto Rico, for example, or even Florida and Texas food banks, when they had to shut down, if they were impacted, we have community partners. So those member agencies are the ones we seek to help do distribution at a larger scale. So if something were to happen here, a snowstorm and a certain, you know, like if it was an ice storm, if I think it was like 98, if that kind of impacts a certain quadrant of our service area, then you can bet I'm calling Samaritan Center and I'm calling Rescue Mission and saying, can you also be an access distribution point, not only for meals that you're serving, but for meals that people can either take, whether they're in a hotel, whether they're in their own home, that they can prepare Pop Top. We also distribute can openers and things. So we are on the same level of disaster response and relief that you would contextually put in American Red Cross.
So you all do a wonderful job, but my concern is the role of the federal and state government. She's smiling already. Because we're in, first of all, how much support do your operations get from the federal and state government, and what are your worries and concerns about, you know, the current things that we hear about plans from the federal government?
I can jump in initially. So Everyone's ready to go. So the Rest Commission receives about 10% of its operating revenue from government sources. And we're about a $20 million budget, just to put that in perspective. So we really have to be quite entrepreneurial in generating revenue. We do that through the 16 thrifty shopper stores that we operate. So when you donate your household items and your clothing to the Rest Commission, we're giving a lot of that away, but then we're selling in our stores and generating money that goes into programs. And then certainly through relationship building and connecting with donors and supporters in the community, we're helping to offset kind of that gap. But virtually everything that we do at the Rest Commission, we have to subsidize at some level. And so the 10% government funding is fairly stable, but what I worry about at the federal level particularly is the proposed $6 billion in cuts to HUD, because if that goes through, we don't receive direct HUD funding at the Rest Commission, but our partner organizations in this community do. And so if they got cut, we would see a dramatic increase in people coming to us for service as well and needing to support those organizations. So cuts at that level could be disastrous for individuals that are on the margins, that are housing vulnerable. That'd be a terrible thing.
From both state and federal funding, we have about 35%. The largest funder is Department of Health, HPNAP Prevention Program, but USDA, the TFAP through the Farm Bill, supplies food bank a little over $1 million of commodities each year. So for me right now, with proposed cuts not only to HUD, all the discretionary areas, so when you look at the Farm Bill and you have proposed cuts of $10 billion that's sitting in the House and Senate for approval, it started out at $193 billion was the president's proposal over 10 years. If families do not have access to SNAP, they are going to come see us more. Mm-hmm. And that is not anything we can sustain. We are currently the essential food network. We are no longer the emergency food network, and it will only escalate if SNAP benefits are cut. So from the Farm Bill perspective and the 10 pieces, it impacts trade and agriculture and SNAP as well as HUD. We're in a very fragile state right now from an emergency food network on where we go and how we will be able to manage the families coming for services to us.
Wow, that's a hard one to follow. it's discouraging. So I'm running for elected office in the area, and my background, this is an issue that's massively important to me, people with food scarcity and how to improve the situation, but also in listening to everyone in the community. As we get off 690 West, as we drive down there, we see the people on both sides of the street with signs, and it just feels like it's a very, for the business owners, for the people down there, they're having a hard time with that being our welcome sign to Syracuse all the time. So I don't want to bash heads or throw people in jail, but how do we solve this in a humanitarian way? How do we, you know, what would your guys' suggestion be to how to meet the needs of everyone in the city with trying to have that not be our flag of entry, but also, you know, I agree with what you said, seeing the humanity in people. I've seen that when you treat people with human kindness, but do we have the time and the resources, and how do we deal with this problem?
Alan, do you want to
start? Yeah, I could try. First of all, I don't know if it's a problem that will ever go away.
Right.
I mean, if you go to any city in America, you're going to find any city of scale in America, you're going to find homelessness, you're going to find panhandling. I mean, that's just a reality of an urban environment at some level. I do think, though, there needs to be greater outreach. The resources for outreach, whether it's just street outreach or mental health outreach in particular, are very limited, and that's, we're feeling that throughout the community. I think one of the things to be aware of is not everyone holding a sign, flying a sign on a corner is homeless. A lot of them are housed, and this is a way that they are, you know, asking for money, receiving money. So that's part of it too. I can tell you our outreach team probably knows 90% of the individuals holding signs by name. And we have a coordinated effort in the community with other organizations doing outreach, like In My Father's Kitchen. They're meeting regularly, talking about the individuals that are out there, and trying to work case plans. We've actually successfully, and we're seeing an increase in this, been able to get people directly off the street and into housing and bypass the shelter system altogether. But it is a challenge. I mean, I think more dollars that can in resources that can go into outreach will make more of a difference. I find it pretty rare that individuals don't necessarily know about the work of the mission or the work of Samaritan Center. There are some that might be newer to the community that don't know, but I think the majority do know. They're dealing with other issues in their life, whether it's mental health issues, behavioral health, addiction. And so we have to be able to meet them where their need is, and that's what the need is at this point.
I want to thank the three of you so much for coming and joining us this morning. Thanks so much.
Thank you.